All right, well, good morning. Good to see everybody out on a little bit of a blustery day, as Winnie the Pooh Bear might say. So we are going to be in Acts chapter 12 today, and so if you were not here for Wednesday night class, on our Wednesday night adult class, we're actually going to be kind of doubling up on the book of Acts, and so I encourage you, if you were not here for Wednesday, you can take time to go back, listen to chapter 11 on the website. Nice thing about chapter 11 is it's mostly a rehash of what happened in chapter 10 and kind of re-going over that and setting us up for what's going to happen in chapter 12. But I do encourage you to go back, listen to that, so that way we'll be getting kind of a double dose of Acts. So if you're missing Wednesday nights, don't forget to make sure you're catching up so you're prepared for what's happening on Sunday. So today we're going to be in Acts chapter 12. And just as a brief overview of where we are, in Acts chapter 10 we have one of the pivotal transition moments in the book of Acts with the introduction of Cornelius the centurion, a Gentile believer in God, who is visited by God, who is given a vision to go and call for Peter. This is all highly irregular. It's highly unusual, both for the Gentile and for the Jewish communities to interact with one another. And yet, what God does to kind of prime the pump for this is show Peter this vision of clean and unclean animals descending from heaven upon a sheet, the voice saying, "Rise, kill, and eat." And basically the point that's being made, and it finally clicks for Peter, is that, okay, what has previously been deemed unclean is now no longer to be deemed unclean. And this really isn't talking so much about food laws as it is the divide between Jew and Gentile. And so Peter goes to Cornelius, he preaches the gospel to them, they receive the Holy Spirit, and Peter and the rest of the Jewish Christians say, what else can we do but to accept these as our brethren? What else can we do but to see the work going on in these people's lives? Chapter 11 essentially does the same thing. Peter goes back to Jerusalem with his Jewish cohort. Everybody in Jerusalem basically wants to know, like, hey, what happened, buddy? Seems like things have changed. Give us a little bit of an understanding of why all of a sudden you are spending time with uncircumcised people and eating with them. And so Peter explains what had happened and essentially gives the same response of, like, what else can we do? If the Holy Spirit is directing us to this, if the Holy Spirit is showing His participation in these Gentile lives, what else can we do but be in fellowship with them, make sure they are offered baptism through water, and essentially welcome them into the Christian church? And even though this will end up being a larger issue, and we'll start seeing that in a couple of chapters, that this tension between Jewish and Gentile Christians is not going to dissipate. There are going to be reoccurrences of this. But in this moment, everything goes very well, and even the those of the circumcision, those who are really concerned about preserving Jewish cultural integrity, even they have to say, well, yeah, okay, but what can we do but accept the will of the Spirit? The chapter then ends with a brief discussion of the formation of the church in Antioch, which appears to be the first multicultural church of Christians, where you're getting both Gentiles, Greek-speaking individuals, as well as the Hebrew Christians are coming together as well. And so chapter ends with preparation for the idea that Barnabas and Saul are going to go to various churches all over the world to produce funds for a famine that's about to come and strike Jerusalem and Judea. But then that story like completely halts, and Luke's like, okay, we introduced that thing, now let's actually jump back over to Jerusalem, speaking of that city, and let's see what's going on there, particularly with Peter. And so this is going to kind of be the last major story that's going to be involving really Peter himself. He's going to make kind of a couple of cameo appearances almost in Paul's story. But this is the last major story of Peter. And I think the purpose of this is it's almost as if Luke and the Spirit working through him is kind of reassuring us that even though the focus is about to shift to the Gentile world in the story, even though the focus is about to shift on what Paul is doing all over the rest of the world, it's almost as if I think Luke and the Spirit are reassuring us that that doesn't mean that the Spirit's still not taking care of the saints in Jerusalem. He hasn't abandoned the first converts because he's like, oh, look at all these new people that I've got to worry about. He's still absolutely caring for the church in Jerusalem, even in the face of the worst persecution they've faced to date. And so this kind of picks up on a couple of different themes. We're seeing persecution is amplifying as the church expands and is becoming more successful, is becoming more well-known. So too, persecution is rising to meet it in equal measure. And we're also seeing that, again, the Spirit, in spite of that, is providing for the church, is protecting the church, and is ensuring that the gospel message is not going to be snuffed out
no matter how powerful the forces against it may be. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and read the first part here of chapter 12. It says, "Now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. When he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. That was during the days of unleavened bread. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God." All right, a couple of names are being thrown out here. We want to make sure we know who we're talking about. First and foremost, who is Herod? Okay, he's a king. King of what? Yeah, so Judea. So this would have been a good time to have a map. I didn't think about that until just now. So if you're looking at, if you want to look at the back of your Bible at a map of Roman Palestine, what you'll see is that the area that we typically refer to as Israel is divided into several different provinces. And so what Rome often did, and particularly in the case of Israel did, was that it took these various regions and allowed local rulers to still be kind of their puppets over those areas. And so Rome is the big power over the entire world at this point in time, but that's a really big thing to try to administer. And so the emperor is in charge of everything, but that's a lot of area for the emperor to be in charge of. So you obviously have a very extensive administrative network that takes care of all of these things. And at times, what would occur is that local rulers would be empowered to still keep their throne so long as they submitted to Roman rule, made sure Rome got its tax money, and made sure to keep the peace. Without getting into too much detail of who all the various players in that is, that's what Herod is he is essentially a king under Rome's authority. And he is particularly over this area of Judea. Now, there's various different peoples that are all affiliated with this. There's also an individual that we read of early in the Gospel accounts, Herod the Great, who's kind of the major ruler of all this area. This Herod is one of his descendants, his grandson, who is ruling over a smaller area. But this is the same Herod, however, that we read of during the crucifixion of Jesus, which I think Luke is very intentionally calling allusions to. Because notice, it's taking place during the days of unleavened bread. And in fact, Luke says specifically that Herod's plan is after the Passover, he's going to kill Peter. There's allusions being made, just like we saw in the death of Stephen, that Stephen's trial and execution is kind of calling to mind, this is very similar to what happened to Jesus. Same thing here. Peter's arrest, his persecution, the death of James, all of these things are calling to mind that, okay, the church is suffering like Jesus suffered. The church is going through the same things as Jesus did, and that shouldn't surprise us. Jesus had told the church, this is what was going to happen. He told the apostles particularly, this is what was going to happen. I think it's really interesting that in verse 5, it makes note that Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being fervently made by the church to God. I think it's interesting that there's no note of Peter being particularly concerned. And I wonder perhaps if this is because Peter is perhaps at this time remembering back to the end of the Gospel of John, where Jesus had basically told him, like, hey, you're going to die for this. Like, you eventually are going to be led to your execution. You'll be taken to places where you do not want to go. Now, spoiler alert, it doesn't happen right here. It will happen later on in Peter's life. But it seems as if, from the very few glimpses we get of the apostles towards the end of their lives, they're never concerned about that. Paul, certainly in the epistles of 2 Timothy, is completely unconcerned about the impending death he's going to face. He's actually relieved in some ways. He's actually quite looking forward to what he's longed for, to see Jesus not just in a vision, but face to face. Peter is actually going to have similar discussions, not quite as frank as Paul does, but in 2 Peter, he's going to kind of allude to the fact that more than likely he himself is facing impending death. And John, again, when he writes in his gospel, talks about the reality that the apostles were going to suffer and be persecuted over this. And so it seems as if the apostles are not surprised by this. And so even when the harsh reality of persecution rears its head, and James, one of the 12, not just one of the 12, but one of the three closest disciples to Jesus, one of the leaders of the 12 and consequently of the early church, is put to death. And it's almost surprising how little attention is paid to that here in the book of Acts. You'd think, like, okay, one of the three most important leaders of the early church is executed by the government. And everybody's just like, oh yeah, it happened. You know, obviously there would have been sorrow about that, but it doesn't stop what's happening. The church doesn't grind to a halt. It's not like, oh man, what are we going to do? It's like, okay, we keep going. What else can we do? But continue to preach the message, continue to live like followers of Jesus. And that's essentially how all the apostles saw themselves, that they didn't see their death as the end of the movement. They realized that even if they died, the words that they had preached, the example that Jesus had given, the life that Jesus had instructed his disciples to follow, none of that would end with the apostles' death. This was never meant to be a movement that only existed because the apostles were around. And I think that's really significant for us that, again, I think Luke is intentionally, I think, portraying the apostles as obviously important, but of vastly secondary importance to the work of the Spirit, to the work of Jesus himself in the person of the Spirit. That ultimately, the fact that we don't have the 12 apostles today doesn't mean that we're fundamentally lost. It doesn't mean that we've somehow strayed far away from the truth, because the Spirit has been the work behind the apostles the entire time. The Spirit has been the power behind this movement. The apostles have been very important parts of that, very important servants to that power. But they ultimately were servants just like everyone else is. And they ultimately were part of the movement, not the head of the movement. And so I think that's an important thing to note in this is that, again, in a lot of religious movements, when you see the leader is deposed or the leader is arrested or the leader is killed, like that ends the movement. I mean, they can't recover from that because that was the visionary. That was the person who they followed. That was the person they looked up to. James, again, is one of the three most important apostles. He's one of the closest ones to Jesus. He would be one of the ones who would be able to tell all these stories. Just like John is able to give us very intimate glimpses into the life of Jesus, he's an eyewitness. James was eyewitness to some really important things. The transfiguration, the garden. There's a lot of these occasions where it's just Peter, James, and John. And yet, in spite of being such an important figure, the work continues. And again, I'm not trying to diminish James at all. Don't misunderstand that. But what I am trying to do is emphasize how much the Spirit is at the heart of this story. How ultimately, the work of the church is the work of the Spirit. And that's why I think we can take great comfort in that, knowing that we are servants of the same Spirit. We are empowered by the same Spirit that has empowered these apostles, and so we can continue the good work that is going on. I've rambled a little bit. Anything else you notice here in the introductory verses here of what's going on? So it's probably a little bit later than that. We're not given, that is one of the things that Luke does not, he just really doesn't bother very much with it. He kind of establishes in the Gospel of Luke, he establishes kind of the date of when all of this is beginning. But then after that, he really doesn't take a whole lot of pains to establish years. He'll establish dates, and so he's drawing attention to the idea that it's Passover. I don't think this is the next Passover after Jesus dies. Now, I can't give much more beyond that. But I do think some amount of time has elapsed. And again, that's just part of the reality of, you know, we kind of live in a culture where that's really super important to us. Like, we want to know exact dates and figures. And that just wasn't really a concern, in this. And that's not to denigrate the history writing of the first century. They were very concerned, and as we've seen, they're very good at history. They're very good at making the points they're trying to make. They just were doing it in a different way than we often do. And so for Luke, the chronological dating is less important than the truth behind the story. What's the spiritual significance of what's going on? And so he's connecting the idea of Passover, but I don't think this is the next year. I think this would be sometime later. But I couldn't tell you much more beyond that. Yes, Mr. Sir. Right. And so more than likely, this is probably in the 40s sometimes. So there are a couple of events that we can pretty accurately date based off of certain different things. And so, for example, we're going to see in chapter 15, the Council of Jerusalem. We can pretty well say that's probably between 48 and 50 AD, based on some different things that are said and different historical records we have later as well. So this is before that, because the Council of Jerusalem hasn't happened yet. So this is before 48 AD, and it's probably after about 37 AD. That's about the range we're going to get. And again, when we're talking about something that's occurred 2,000 years ago, that's actually incredibly precise. But so, yes, I would probably guess this is probably early 40s, somewhere around then. It kind of depends on whether we think what occurs in the end of chapter 12 is like right after what happens at the beginning of chapter 12, or if there's some time elapsed there. Again, Luke just doesn't specifically tell us that. So that is part of the challenge, and I freely admit the dating and everything of the New Testament is not one of my areas of expertise. There's a lot of good sources out there that have done a lot of the legwork, a lot of the comparison between Roman records and comparison between early church sources, comparing that to what the Bible is saying. There's a lot of good works out there. That's just not one of the areas that I'm particularly well familiar with. So best I can kind of tell you is I think this is probably early 40s, give or take. Other thoughts or comments we see going on here? Yes, sir, Tim? Yeah, and I think that probably kind of gives us a fairly accurate time period. Again, part of this is that even the dating of exactly when did Jesus die is also kind of a guess. It's an educated guess. We can pretty well say it's probably somewhere between 30 and 33 AD. This is a total side note. But sometimes even those things, there's like weird quirks in the historical record. So more than likely you have probably heard that Jesus was about 30 years old when he died. There's a source from the first century that says Jesus was 50 years old when he died. It's very early. And he's a Christian. He's writing about these things. I don't know what to do with that. Like, it's a first century, it's first and second century sources that say that. There's others that say other things. And so, there's just little odd quirks, and the age of Jesus does not make any difference to the veracity of the Bible. And so that's why I can kind of bring that one up, and I don't think that's a big deal. But even just some of those datings and everything, there's just some weird quirks sometimes in the historical record. You're like, okay, how do we reconcile these things? And sometimes the answer is like, okay, maybe this guy's just way off, and he heard something somewhere, and he just ran with it. Because we've all made mistakes before. So all I bring that up to say is that the dating and everything and trying to nail that down, it's never going to quite give us the full satisfaction like we have when we can say, at 6:35 p.m. on April 11th of 1992, this happened. The reality is we're just never going to be able to be that precise based on the methods that were being used at the time. So that's why you'll tend to see there's kind of guesses of like, Galatians is written somewhere between 52 and 55 A.D. And we're like, that seems like a really broad number. It's actually incredibly precise for the standards of the time and the information that we can gather. So that's one of those things. Again, it's a really interesting study to look at all those things, and sometimes that can be really beneficial. But it is ultimately, in some ways, it feels like kind of throwing darts in some ways. But yeah, so like I said, I guess somewhere around 40, I think, is probably a pretty fair guess of when this is occurring. So again, the church is still very young. I mean, that means we're less than a decade old when all of this is occurring. This is still a very burgeoning movement, still very nascent in its infancy. And so again, that's what's impressive about this, is that in spite of being such a young movement, in spite of losing one of its main leaders, and almost losing the main leader in many capacities, the reality is that it doesn't really hinder the movement at all. In fact, the movement continues to expand and explode. Any other thoughts or comments on the introductory things here? All right, so Peter is in prison. Everyone is very, very worried about him. Herod is, and everybody knows, Herod is intending to kill him. It says in verse 6, on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly." And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. He said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." All right, before we get into the second part of this, I think this is just a really interesting story. And I can totally relate to Peter waking up and being so dazed and so tired and so confused. He's like, "I literally don't know what's happening. I'm just, okay, just following whatever you're telling me to." Thinking the whole time that he's dreaming. And clearly, it's some moments after the angel has just disappeared that, you know, he's like, oh, cool, okay, I'm out, hey, we did it, we're out. it's such an incredible thing. I think Luke is almost taking pains. And again, Luke and the rest of the gospel authors are, it's very interesting to me. And this is to me genuinely one of the strongest arguments for the veracity of the gospel and Acts as well. Is that there are a lot of times where the apostles, again, remember, the leaders of the church, are made to look like absolute goofballs. And Peter literally, like, stumbles and bumbles his way out of the dark, like, is just being led, and it takes him, like, 30 minutes to figure out what's happening, because he's so tired and so confused. This is not like, oh man, what an incredibly wise and incredible person that Peter is. You're just like, oh man, Peter's, that, yeah, I've been that tired before. I've stumbled and bumbled my way out of the bed not knowing what's going on. And again, the power of this, and it's made very clear, Peter's got nothing to do with what's going on. The angel takes the chains off. The angel keeps the guards sleeping. The angel sneaks him past all these guards without him noticing. He opens the gates by itself. Nothing that Peter has done is by himself. And again, I think this is part of Luke's argument here, is like, y'all, there's no way Peter did this. Peter's not even awake. Like, Peter's literally like half asleep, stumbling through this. There's no way he did this by himself. And Luke is offering, again, I think there's a little bit of humor here, but more importantly, Luke is basically saying, like, hey, guys, this is clearly, once again, the Spirit at work. If you're trying to deny the works of God, you've got to explain how Peter got out of prison. From a king that we all knew had just killed James and was looking to kill him. And so again, I think Luke very subtly is making the argument for the presence of the Spirit in this, for the power of God at work in this occasion. You see that several different times. You see it in the Gospel of Matthew, where it's recorded like, hey, the Jews wanted to try to explain the body of Jesus missing as the apostles had stolen it. But we know that that's not true. And you see almost very subtly the authors are trying to kind of dismantle potential arguments that might be brought up. Ah, well, you know, Peter probably just managed to get out, or he bribed the guard. Well, then you got to explain how his chains fell off, how the guards stayed asleep, and how the gate opened up all by itself. And so they're kind of building an apologetic, defensive case for why the events that are occurring are true. And again, Luke is not here himself. But Luke is clearly building this as an eyewitness case off of Peter. So Peter is kind of like being very humble, I think, and recalling, like, I had no idea what was going on. I thought I was dreaming, and I saw all these things, and it wasn't until several minutes later that I was like, oh, that must have been what happened, was this was an angel helping them. And so we're seeing that these are clearly treasured stories from the lives of the apostles, from the lives of the early disciples, that to them were like, hey, this is proof that God was looking out for us, that the only way I got out of that prison was an angel led me. I had no ability to do that. Tim? Yeah, the Romans are like, we got to stop losing people. Like, this, like we. Yeah, and again, especially for, like, you have to imagine how desperately, particularly the early Jewish leaders, and then eventually probably the Romans, were doing anything in their power to discredit what had occurred. And doing anything in their power to be like, oh no, well, you know what, we just had bad soldiers there and Peter probably just snuck out the window or something. Oh, you know, the body didn't raise from the dead, you guys just stole the body. Come on, we know what really happened. Again, all of these would be very common arguments for anti-Christian figures to be like, hey, this is clearly mistaken. And so again, you're seeing the gospel writers are taking great pains. You're like, no, that you can't make that argument. Like, you can try to debate this, like you can try to bring your evidence, but you can't try to cheat out the easy way. Like, you've got to explain something that can't be explained through natural means. And that ultimately is one of the reasons why I think you see so many people are believing this, is they're hearing these things, and yes, there's obviously a response of faith and a movement of the Spirit, but there's also the reality that they have really good arguments for why what happened really happened. That this wasn't just some myth, this wasn't just some story that they had made up in a world that many stories were made up. They're like, no, we actually have evidence for this. Like, we have eyewitnesses to these things. We have people that have risked death for this story. This is not a made-up story. This is something that has truly happened. And I think that's part of what's being preserved in these writings, is those early attempts to ironclad that case. Shannon? Squads. That is a great question that I honestly do not know. I would have to... That would be, yeah, so that's not going to be a full century. It would probably be that next... And like I said, this is something that at one point I did know. But yeah, this would probably be about total... You're talking about somewhere between like 120 and 160 soldiers are... And so essentially, he's in the middle of a barracks, is what's really going on. This is basically, he's like in the middle of some sort of Roman facility, that's going on here in the middle of Jerusalem. And so more than likely this is the garrison that, this is where they, the soldiers were housed for the whole city. But yeah, he essentially is, he's like the sole person that they're watching out for. So yeah, this is probably somewhere between 100 and 150 soldiers, give or take. So, like I said, at one point I probably knew that exact word that's being used there and what that would mean, but even then, again, historical vagaries. Sometimes Romans used words like century, which means 100, and sometimes that's between like 75 and like 200 people. And so sometimes even the words don't exactly mean what the word itself you think it means. So, all those things are the fun details that historians would work out. Other thoughts and comments that we see in this section here, or questions. Can you imagine like the wince that must have happened when those chains, like big iron chains just fall off and clang, grinds, like, oh, okay, well, they're clearly going to come. Oh, nobody's coming. I'm going to put on my sandals, get a cloak, I'm going to just put words, just going to keep walking. Okay, well, this is clearly not real. Like, I'm clearly envisioning these things. And so, well, so presumably, so most of the time, this is what I think is really interesting when you study, angels. Most of the time when angels appear, they're actually completely unrecognizable until after the fact. Most of the time, and several times, we see this a lot in the Old Testament, angels will appear and people have no idea who they are. Think about, Lot, when he entertains the two strangers that come in. He just thinks they're two guys. Like, just thinks they're two random guys. Abraham does the same thing with those two and the angel of the Lord, who ultimately is revealed to be Yahweh himself. He just thinks they're people. And we see that actually a lot, that most of the time when angels come, you know, we get these artistic depictions of these, you know, massive warriors and these huge angel wings and everything like that. And everybody's like, oh, it's an angel. And most of the time people have to be like, oh, that was an angel that just came. I just realized that. And so I think that's more than likely what's going on here, is that this is essentially, Peter just thinks he's seeing some dude like come in, and like all of a sudden weird stuff starts happening. And then that's why he says after the fact that he's like, oh, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent an angel. He sent forth his angel, and there's interesting terminology there, and rescued me from the hand of Herod from all the Jewish people were expecting. It's not until after the fact that he's like, oh, that must have been what just happened. So again, Peter kind of, in a humorous scene, is just kind of watching, like, wow, this is really weird that all this is happening. We're just going through, this must be a dream of some sort. It's not until after the fact that he puts it all together, like, oh, that's what just happened. So yeah, it must have been just a fascinating scene, and I'm sure Peter just had all the beats of that story perfectly covered, and had all the good moments of like, and the chains dropped, and I couldn't believe that nobody woke up. And it must have been a story that many people had heard, and Luke wanting to preserve that and showing, again, prime example of how the Lord was working to protect his people. Any other things we notice on Peter's end before we get to the reaction of the church, which is also humorous? And in fact, this is really funny. So Peter is literally like in the middle of the street, the angels disappeared, and Peter like finally like kind of wakes up and is like, oh, okay. Now what? So it says when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. They said to her, you are out of your mind. But she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying, it is his angel. But Peter continued knocking. And when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison. And he said, report these things to James and the brethren. Then he left and went to another place. Now when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. When Herod had searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. So we get what I think is one of the funniest stories in the Bible, is Peter, who is, you know, again, think about what Peter's been going through. Peter has been in prison for some amount of time. He's not being well treated in that prison, just pointedly. So he's going to be dirty. He's going to probably stink. He's going to be probably not particularly well fed and everything. When Peter's just incredibly thankful that he's gotten out of here alive. And he realizes, as we see at the end of it, he's got to get out of Dodge in some capacity. But he wants to make sure that the church knows that he's safe. And so he goes to one of the houses that they're all gathered, John Mark's mother Mary, and the servant girl, who I think it's incredible that she's named, which probably means Luke also interviewed her. I think this is a little bit more of a theory than anything. My suspicion is that if somebody is named, Luke probably talked to them. That Luke talks a very big deal about being eyewitnesses, talking to people. I suspect if somebody is named in the narrative, that means that he got to go speak to that person. It wasn't just, I heard a story about this person. No, like, I got to go talk to that person. That's a theory. I can't 100% prove that, but that's how I tend to read these things. So she recognizes Peter's voice and runs back in to tell everybody, which I can visualize Peter as he's standing there looking around, like trying to make sure. He's knocking on the door. He hears somebody come, says something, and then they walk away. Can you imagine Peter's freaking out at that moment of like, what are you doing? Open the door. It's me. Banging on the door and like, please let me in. And she's in there debating with the rest of the church. Like, no, really, it's Peter. Ah, you're crazy. It can't be Peter. He's dead. It's that word there, his angel, literally means you saw his spirit. You saw some sort of ghost, basically. It couldn't have really been Peter. So now they're really upset. That confirms for them that Peter's already been executed ahead of time. And this poor servant goes like begging, like, guys, I'm telling you. He's right. She doesn't just go open the door and just let him in. She's in there trying to argue. Have you ever been in an argument and then you suddenly have this moment like, wait a second, why are we arguing about this? Let me just go open the door that Peter's banging on. And so finally, somebody hears Peter, whether it's Rhoda or somebody else, and they open the door, and it is Peter. It's not a ghost. It's Peter. And of course, they all immediately start freaking out because it says they saw him and were amazed. But Peter, motioning with his hand to be quiet, so they all start freaking out. Shh, I'm an escaped convict. Let's not bring everybody's attention. It's the middle of the night. We don't need Roman soldiers coming here. Okay, I'm okay. I'm not staying here. I'm going somewhere else. Report these things, interestingly, to James and the brethren. Okay, well, we just read that James is dead. Who is this James? Yeah, so this is one of the early mentions of James, the brother of Jesus, and Luke doesn't actually take time to explain who that is, so kind of reintroduce James in a later time. But he basically says, like, hey, go tell all the other leaders of the church, go tell everybody, I'm okay, I made it out. And then he goes, and he goes to another place. He doesn't even tell them where he's going. He just gets out of Dodge. And so again, I think this is so funny that Luke preserves this story, and it does add, I think, an air of authenticity to what's going on, that Luke is including a very embarrassing account for pretty much everybody involved. Like, this is a very funny story. And it's interesting to see that, because we often tend to read the Bible, again, as a very legal, rule-oriented thing, but the Bible is fundamentally a story. And it's telling us a story. It's telling us about real human interactions with really weird and bizarre events. And the way that people react is, I think, pretty realistic of how I think we would all react to these events. Like, it captures the human element of this. That this is not some grand mythology, but it's a real story of real people, essentially, I think, telling their stories to Luke. And telling them, like, yeah, this, I remember when I heard Peter's voice and I was so goofy, I just ran back to everybody. I didn't even think to open the door. And you can almost hear how Luke is hearing these stories and piecing them all together and showing how the early church really was. How it was this collection of sometimes fallible, sometimes embarrassing, sometimes really goofy people. But look at how these ordinary people are being radically transformed and accomplishing incredible things through the power of the Spirit. Through the power of the Spirit that is a direct continuation of the ministry of Jesus, this incredible person that you can't explain it any other way other than he is God incarnate. So we'll pick up the story there. We'll continue. We'll kind of see the conclusion of this story with Herod being struck down and then the beginning of the missionary journeys and what's going to go on with our new buddy Saul. Thank you very much.